And renunciation is the first of the three principles of the path that we need to generate, because that's what actually turns our mind to Dharma practice. Okay? So we see here that the eight worldly concerns are really, really important, and they can create a lot of problems for us, both in our life and in our Dharma practice. Okay? So they have disadvantages because they cause suffering now and they cause suffering in the future. Because we can see, for example, with the first one, the more attached we are to having money and material possessions, the more we suffer when the stock market goes down, the more we suffer when people forget our birthday, okay? The more we worry about money and things like that. So that causes unhappiness now. And then also, because of that mental unhappiness, because of that attachment and aversion, then we get involved in all sorts of negative actions to procure and protect our money and our possessions. Okay? So, you know, somebody might come to take something and we beat them up, or, you know, we lie to get material things, so we can create a host of negative karma in pursuit of these, you know, these eight. And so that brings more suffering in future lives, in addition to the unhappiness right now. Okay, we can see that similarly, you know, the more we're seeking for praise and approval, then just even this life, we get so unhappy, you know, because if people don't praise us, we feel resentful, we feel unappreciated. If the people we love don't tell us that they love us enough, we feel unworthy, we get angry. So we're miserable now. And then in addition, in order to get, you know, the kind of approval and praise, you know, we might go against our own ethical principles to fit into a group. We might nag and pester people. We might do all sorts of things, you know, to get them to like us or to say nice, sweet, ego-pleasing words to us. And we do all sorts of negative actions when they blame us, you know, especially when we look at the four negative actions of speech, you know, lying, divisive words, harsh speech, and gossip. You know, we often get quite involved in those because other people have blamed us for something, rightly or wrongly. Okay, so then we create all that negative karma, and that brings us suffering in the future. Okay, so the same thing with reputation. More we're attached to reputation, more suffering we have this life. I mean, some people even kill themselves because their reputation gets ruined. No, a lot of people commit suicide. Now, so that's a lot of suffering this life. And then similarly, in order to get a good reputation, we can lie and deceive and manipulate. Or when we get a bad reputation, again, we deprecate others, do all sorts of really nasty things, which creates negative karma, which brings suffering. Okay? Then the, you know, the attachment to the pleasures of the senses. We do all sorts of things to get them too. We oversleep in the morning to have more pleasure of, you know, lying in bed and sleeping. We, you know, stuff our food down really fast so we can get seconds before anybody else can. You know, we, you know, sometimes can get really quite nasty to getting the sense pleasures that we want. Somebody makes food that we don't like at a restaurant, we send it back and we criticize them and make them unhappy. Okay, so we have a lot of misery this lifetime. You know, if you go to India, boy, you know, all your attachment to pleasant senses are really challenged. So before we were talking about unpleasant smells. Well, you go to India, lots of unpleasant smells, you know? So, and you know, many things that are dirty. So then you come running back to, you know, to your home full of criticism for other people because of unpleasant sensations that we had. And then again, creating so much negative karma because of that brings suffering in future lives. Okay, so these eight worldly concerns are like a huge problem. And they're the first level of things that we really have to deal with in our practice. And like I told you last time, you know, my teacher Zopa Rinpoche, he would do a whole month-long meditation course on the eight worldly concerns, really to emphasize to us to pay attention to these. Because if we don't work on these eight, what else are we going to work on? You know, we say that we're Dharma practitioners. Well, if we aren't working on overcoming these eight, then what are we doing in our Dharma practice? What are we working to overcome if it's not these basic principle eight things that come at the beginning? Okay? How are we going to overcome dualistic appearances if we can't even give up our chocolate? Okay? How are we going to overcome selfishness if we can't, you know, endure a little bit of blame or whatever? Okay? So, you know, if we aren't working on these eight, then we have to ask ourselves, what am I doing in my practice? You know, what does practicing Dharma mean? Because practicing Dharma means transforming our mind. It doesn't mean just looking on the outside like we're a Dharma practitioner. It means actually doing something with our mind. And so these eight are the foundation thing that we have to really work with. So plenty of work to do here. I asked you to keep a journal. Yeah? You've been doing that? No?
I just jot down.
Okay. Okay, good. Keep doing it now, and next time I'll ask you about it. And if you haven't done anything, then I'll ask you which of the eight worldly concerns distracted you from doing it.
All of them.
All of them, right. Because also, you know, we look when we sit down to meditate, you know, what is it that interferes with our meditation? It's always these eight. Always. Mm-hmm. You know? So, you know, if we want to develop concentration in our meditation, we have to work with this. Okay. Now, along this line, I wanted to talk a little bit about the Kadampa tradition. This is a tradition in Tibetan Buddhism that I really, really admire. Buddhism came to Tibet in two waves. The first transmission to Tibet was in the 7th century. Then there was some persecution by a Tibetan king. And then in the late 10th century, early 11th century, there was another transmission of Buddhism to Tibet. And that's at the time when Lama Atisha came, and he's the one who began the whole cycle of teachings on the gradual path. Well, from Lama Atisha, there developed what's called the Kadam tradition. Okay? And these were very, very great spiritual practitioners who lived a very, very simple and humble life. You know, they weren't ostentatious, they weren't, you know, all arrogant, they just lived extremely, extremely simply. And they really paid attention to transforming their minds and working on these eight worldly concerns. So the Tibetans have a lot of stories about these practitioners. And there's one in particular, his name was Ben Kungyal. And he, you know, was really, really firm with himself about these eight worldly concerns. So there's a story that one time, you know, he was a monk and he was invited to a layperson's house for lunch. And so while the family was in the kitchen preparing the food, he noticed a jar with some cookies out in the room where he was. And he really liked these kind of cookies. The Tibetans make these kind of fried bread-like cookies. So he, you know, the family was in the other room. There's this jar of cookies there. So he just goes over, opens the jar, and he sticks his hand in, and he has his hand on the cookie. And then he realizes what he's doing. And with his other hand, he grabs the hand that's in the cookie jar and says, "Come, come, there's a thief in the house. There's a thief in the house." And the family runs in from the kitchen, and he's standing there holding his arm and saying, "This person is stealing your cookies. You better stop him." Okay. So, I mean, that's what a real practitioner with integrity is like. You know, it's like he's not afraid to proclaim his own faults and call himself a thief. Okay? Because at that moment, his eight worldly dharmas, and which one, which of the eight was controlling him at that time? Which of the eight made him take the cookie?
The last pair.
The last one, yeah. You know, attachment to sense pleasure, in particular taste. Okay, so that's what made him take the cookie. So he caught himself, and, you know. So I really like that story. I keep thinking, you know, we should really have that same attitude ourselves to be able to catch ourselves. And then the ability to overcome our attachment to reputation and be able to proclaim our own faults. So the Kadampa masters had a practice called the 10 innermost jewels of the Kadampa. And I really like this practice. And it's, when you listen to it, it sounds really, really tough. And I think it is really, really tough. But at the same time, I know that just meditating on it, just even letting my mind think about these ideas and trying to train my mind in these ideas, just even that I can see has a very positive influence on my mind, even if I'm not capable of living by these 10, 100%. Okay, so I thought I'd go over these because, you know, sometimes you don't often get these in teachings, and I think they're quite valuable, especially as a way of overcoming the eight worldly concerns. So they're called the 10 innermost jewels of the Kadampa. Okay, so they're divided into three groups. The first is called the four trusting acceptances. And the next one is called the three Vajra convictions. And then the last one is called mature attitudes towards being expelled, finding, and attaining. Okay, so let's start at the beginning. So the first set, the four trusting acceptances. So these are the first four of the 10. Okay, so the first one is as our innermost outlook on life, being willing to accept the Dharma with total trust. Okay? So to do this, we reflect on the fact that we've received a precious human life, that death is certain and the time of death is uncertain, and that our body and possessions and wealth don't benefit us in death time. And so understanding all of that, you know, as the innermost attitude on life, we, you know, accept the Dharma and commit ourselves to practicing the Dharma. Okay, so that's the first one. That gets us going. Okay, now the second one after that gets a little bit tougher. Okay, the second one is, as our innermost attitude towards following the Dharma, being willing to accept with total trust, even becoming a beggar. Okay. Now what this means is sometimes when we start to practice the Dharma, we have a lot of fear. Oh, if I practice the Dharma, if I give up attachment to the happiness of this life, you know, if I don't work, then I'm going to be really poor, I'm going to be a beggar. And if I'm a beggar, you know, I'm afraid of starving, I'm afraid of sleeping on the streets, I'm afraid of being despised by people. You know, all this fear comes up of being a beggar, being really down and out. Okay? And we may have that when we start to practice the Dharma, because we begin to see, you know, that if we're really committed to the Dharma practice, we're going to give up chasing for money and, you know, material security and things. So a lot of fear can arise. It's very natural. So when this happens, then to accept as our innermost attitude towards towards Dharma practice, the willingness to become a beggar, even if it's necessary. Okay? So just saying, being able to say to ourselves, okay, if, you know, Dharma practice is so valuable, it's so meaningful in my life, that if it means that I have to become a beggar, so be it. That's okay with me. Okay? That's a hard attitude to have, isn't it? Yeah, that's not an easy attitude to have. But just even meditating like this, trying to cultivate that attitude, you know, gets us working to go against our eight worldly concerns. Okay, then the third one is, as our innermost attitude towards becoming a beggar, being willing to accept with total trust even having to die. Okay, so, you know, if we get past, okay, I'll practice the Dharma, I'm okay with becoming a beggar, you know, I'll manage being poor, but I don't want to die, okay? You know, being poor is one thing, but I don't want to die because of being poor. So then a lot of fear of death comes up, and like, you know, I don't want to die, this can't happen, I've got to preserve my life at all costs. And that could make us, that kind of fear can, you know, very easily make us leave our Dharma practice. Or even if we don't leave our Dharma practice totally, that kind of fear can make us create negative karma, you know, let's say by stealing from other people because we don't want to die. Okay, so here, in order to counteract it, what we have to think is, you know, I've died many times before in my beginningless lives and cyclic existence. You know, dying is nothing new. But, you know, how many times have I died in order to practice the Dharma? Now, I've had all these lifetimes. I've had so much pleasure. And I've died many times. But how many times have I ever practiced the Dharma and reaped its benefit? And of all the deaths I've gone through, how many of them have been in order to do something worthwhile with my life, like practice the Dharma? So if you think in this way, then you get to the point where you say, okay, even if I'm poor, I'm willing to die because that's how meaningful the Dharma practice is in my life. You know? And we realize that it's better to have the Dharma in our hearts and die of poverty than to forsake the Dharma and be surrounded by riches. Okay? Because we see very clear in our mind that at the time of death, all the riches in the world don't help us. But Dharma does, and for sure we're going to die. So it's much better to have the Dharma and die than to live a little while longer without the Dharma and have riches, but then die without the Dharma. Okay. And then the fourth one is, as our innermost attitude towards death, being willing to accept with total trust even having to die friendless and alone in an empty place, in an empty cave, in a deserted place. Okay, so this brings up, you know, we get past the thing, okay, I'll practice the Dharma, I'm willing to be poor, okay, I'm willing to die, but if I die, I don't want to die alone, you know. And what's going to happen to my body if I die? I want to die surrounded by my friends and relatives. I want to die in a nice, comfortable bed. If I die for the Dharma, at least I want people to know about it and have a little bit of fame and recognition for the sacrifice that I'm making, you know? So that kind of fear comes up at that point. So here, in this one, what we're trying to do is see, you know, is to overcome that fear and to say, okay, even if I die, I'm willing to die alone, it's okay. And we can get to that place in our mind because we see that even if we're surrounded by everybody we love at the time of death, none of them can keep us from dying. None of them can keep us from going to the lower realms. None of them can keep us from suffering. Okay? And in fact, dying surrounded by a bunch of people that we're attached to can sometimes make death more difficult. Okay? So we get to the point here where we're willing to say, actually, it's okay with me to die alone. It's okay, you know, because I'll have practiced the Dharma, I'll have the Dharma in my mind, I won't have all the distraction of my wailing friends and relatives, you know, I'll be able to focus on my practice, so even I die alone, that's okay. And I don't care about what happens to my body, because after I'm dead, who needs this body anyway? You know, this body is just a piece of organic vegetable matter. You know, the worms might as well have a good lunch. So I'm not going to care about anybody finding my body, embalming it, putting an ad in the newspaper, you know, an obituary, and with, you know, all these lauds that we give to people, you know, all the praise we give to people after they die. We criticize them when they're alive, but after they die, oh, they're so nice, they're so wonderful. Okay, so we're willing to say, you know, that stuff's totally meaningless. Yeah, if my Dharma practice leads to poverty, okay. If it leads to death, okay. If it leads to dying alone, that's okay, because I'm going to be able to make my own mind happy through practicing the Dharma. Okay. So do you see how thinking about these four helps us face a lot of the fear that we have and a lot of the attachment to the eight worldly concerns? You know, just even thinking about this really helps to free our mind. Okay, then the second set of the ten is called the three Vajra convictions, or the three diamond convictions. Sometimes it's also called the three abandonments. So the first one is called sending the uncatchable diamond ahead of you. Okay, so sending the uncatchable diamond ahead of you. What that means is that, you know, we can make the decision to practice the Dharma, and, you know, that's going to bring about a change in our lifestyle. You know, we're going to simplify our life, we may ordain, you know, we may cut out a lot of social activities because we see they aren't so valuable. And what happens then is that other people will run after us and try us to bring us back to who we used to be. Yeah. And you see this sometimes when you really start to practice the Dharma. Sometimes our old family and our friends go, What? I don't know you anymore. Who are you anymore? You got to come out drinking with me, you know. What, you're going to a meditation retreat? What kind of life is that? You know, get a life. Let's go to Hawaii for your vacation. You know, you can't go to a meditation retreat for your holiday. And so we find that our friends and relatives try and catch us and bring us back to our old identity and our own way of life. So what sending the uncatchable diamond ahead of us means is that we have to be uncatchable. Okay, we can't let the attachment of our friends and relatives catch us and drag us back to the life that we used to live, which involves a lot of attachment and aversion and distraction. Okay? Then the second one is called laying the unabashable diamond behind us. Okay, laying the unabashable diamond behind us. So what this means is to abandon thinking about what other people think about us, and abandon wanting to please other people's worldly aspirations. Okay? So again, you know, a lot of times what happens is, you know, not only will people try and catch us, but then our own mind gets hooked and we say, oh, well, Buddhism teaches about compassion, so if I'm going to be compassionate to my family, I won't go on the meditation retreat. I'll go to Disneyland with my family. Well, that isn't very good logic, okay? Because sometimes we use that as an excuse to not practice the Dharma, or we're afraid of what other people are going to think about us. Yeah, so we give up our practice, or we give up our ethical principles in order to meet other people's expectations and to please them. And this can be a super big hindrance in our practice. Now, I remember when I used to live in Italy, there was one young man who ordained there, and he was from a pretty wealthy family. And I always had a lot of economic problems as a nun, you know, especially the beginning years. I didn't have very much at all. And his family, you know, gave him all this money. He could go to so many teachings. He had heat in his room. He didn't have any problem, you know, living as a monk. And I was having all these problems. And I used to, you know, kind of look and say, you know. But then I saw what happened is his family then demanded he had to go home for Christmas, he had to go on family holidays, he had to do this and that and the other thing with his family. And so he wasn't really free to practice the Dharma because his own mind was attached to his family and his family was pulling on him and he wanted to please them. And so when I realized that, then I said, hey, wait a minute, I'm not jealous of his situation. You know, I actually have a much better deal. It's much better to be poor and have the kind of freedom I have than to have enough money like he does, but in his mind he's not free. Mm-hmm. So this doesn't mean here that we go out of our way to offend people. We're not talking about that. We're just talking about being clean, clear in our priorities so that we don't get distracted. And then the third one is lay the is keep your wisdom diamond by your side. Okay? Keep our wisdom diamond by our side. So what this means is to carry on continuously and conscientiously with our practice without getting caught up in useless concerns. Okay? So what that boils down to is abandoning the eight worldly concerns, because those are the useless concerns we get caught up with. Okay. It also means abandoning the mind of discouragement. So abandoning the mind that criticizes ourselves and says, oh, I'm not a good enough practitioner, I'm a failure, you know, all these kinds of things. You know, if I instead of practicing the Dharma, if I had run a business for those last 10 years, I could be really rich and secure now. So, you know, what a failure I am because I practiced the Dharma. You know, these kinds of regrets that people might have. So again, you know, we have to work really hard to keep ourselves from having those. Okay, so those are the three Vajra or diamond convictions. Okay, and then the next set. And these are the last three of the 10 innermost jewels of the Kadampa, is called the mature attitudes towards being expelled, finding, and attaining. Okay, so the first one of these means being willing to be expelled from the ranks of so-called normal people because we don't share their limited values. Okay. So this doesn't mean that we'll definitely be expelled from the ranks of normal people, but it means, at least in our life, if this happens, being okay with it. And sometimes it does happen, you know. Other people get really upset with us because we have different values and they don't want to be around us. They criticize us. They expel us from their social groups. I mean, it happens to many people I know, that because they practice the Dharma, then their family is unhappy because they're not going to have material security, and their family kicks them out. Or if they practice the Dharma, they're not going to have children, so their family gets mad because the parents want grandchildren. You know, so, and just even, you know, even in regular society, when we really practice the Dharma sincerely, some people, they do criticize us, and even some Buddhists criticize us. I mean, I've heard people say, especially about living a monastic life, they say, oh, if you're a monastic, you know, you're just afraid of intimacy. You know, you go to the monastery because you're trying to escape the world. You know, because you can't handle relationships, or if you're a monastic, you're repressing your sexuality. And let alone, you know, non-Buddhists say this. I've heard Buddhists, lay people, criticize the Sangha for this. So, you know, we have to be willing to bear this kind of criticism without doubting our practice and without doubting the Buddhist teachings. And so this ability to endure their criticism comes not through shutting it out and just saying, I'm not going to listen, but by looking and saying, is what they criticize me for true? You know? They criticize monastics for avoiding relationship problems. Is that why the Buddha made a Sangha community for everybody who couldn't handle a marriage? You know, I don't think so. And I don't think the Buddha himself was indicative of somebody who's repressing his sexuality because he can't handle it and was a flake seeking, you know, an escape from society. Now, so we look at wisdom or what their criticisms are, and we see that they're untrue. And then, you know, then if these people expel us, if they criticize us, it's okay, you know. They can think what they want, but I know the truth for myself because I've checked up my own wisdom. Okay? Or the second one here is being willing to be regarded among the ranks of dogs, or finding ourselves among the ranks of dogs. So again, this doesn't mean that we're going to be hanging out in the gutter with the dogs, although Naga would certainly like us to hang out more with him and play with him some more. But what it means is, even if we have to face hardship in our practice, we're willing to go through the hardship, okay? And this is a very, very essential thing to be able to practice the Dharma, because if every time we face hardship, we fall apart and we want security and comfort instead, we're never going to get anywhere in our practice. Okay, so finding ourselves among the ranks of dog, it means, you know, even if sometimes we're poor, going, you know, being willing to be poor so that we can continue to practice the Dharma. If it means being uncomfortable because we have to travel somewhere, you know, to attend a teaching, then really being willing to be uncomfortable to travel somewhere and get the teaching. Yeah, if it, you know, means being criticized by people, then okay, we're willing to be criticized because we know the value of the Dharma. And, you know, it's so important to be able to practice purely that we're not swayed by what the general public thinks, because the general public, and often, unfortunately, even Buddhists themselves, have very worldly values, and they value people who look good instead of people who actually practice. So you'll see, like at the great Tibetan yogi Milarepa, okay, who lived in the 11th century, he attained enlightenment in this very lifetime, and he had been a criminal before he started practicing the Dharma. So, you know, if there's hope for him, there's definitely hope for us. But, you know, he did really sincere practice, and he was very poor, so he just ate the nettles that grew by his cave, and he wore very simple clothing, and people would look at him and they would feel so sorry for him. And his sister came one time to visit him and said, "My brother, my dear brother, you know, you're so poor and you're eating such rotten food and you're living in a cave and you're freezing and your clothes are rags. You know, why don't you go be this Buddhist scholar and that teach a lot of people because they'll give you money and offerings and then you can have a good life. And he said, forget it. You know, if you think I'm going to sell my Dharma practice to have a comfortable life, you know, that's, what use is that? Now, so he went on then to explain how in the degenerate times in which we live, you know, very often people who look good are proclaimed as very great Buddhist masters, but those people don't necessarily practice, whereas some people who are real practitioners, other people just totally ignore and criticize. Now, and you can see it very, very clearly nowadays. And I know one teacher of mine, you'll hear me talk about him a lot, Geshe Yeshe Thobten. And I mean, he really practiced these 10 jewels of the Kadampa. Incredibly humble, you know, such a humble teacher. And he used to, his hair was usually a little bit too long, so it was this gray hair kind of sticking up. And very wrinkled, and his lower skirt, we call it a shemdap, was always too high, and his socks were falling down, and he kind of shuffled because he had these old shoes, and his robes were usually dirty because he lived up in a cave above Dharamsala, you know. And he'd come into town, and if people didn't know who he was, they'd say, "My goodness, you know, look at that kind of dirty old monk." He didn't look like anybody special. But, I mean, he was this incredible practitioner. And he did his practice totally secretly. You know, totally secretly. I mean, he did the highest tantric practice and everything, but he never showed anybody anything of it. You know, extremely humble, you know. When he was invited to Italy to teach, and I was there at the time that he arrived in Italy, and we had nice china and silverware for him to eat with. And his the first meal he was there, he didn't even know us, you know. First meal, he looks at these dishes and the silverware, and he says, "Get rid of these and bring me a plastic plate. You know, I'm not going to eat off of this stuff." And then he came in to teach, and we had prepared this big Dharma seat, you know, because you respect your teacher, you make a very big Dharma seat, you know, and with a very nice, you know, enamel cup with tea, and, you know, a very nice seat. And he walks up there, and he pulls the cushion off the seat, puts it on the floor, and sits on the floor. You know, he wouldn't sit on the big seat that we had made for him. So, welcome. So, you know, he was a real practitioner along these lines. And, you know, if people criticized him, he didn't care. You know, he lived in poverty in this cave up above Dharamsala. It was cold there. And, you know, I visited him one day in the cave. It's cold. It was dirty, you know. I mean, he kept the cave clean as he could. But, you know, still, when you live in a cave, it's never completely clean. You know, he was a real great practitioner. So, you know, being willing to do that. Yeah? Okay, so there was being willing to be expelled from the ranks of so-called normal people, being willing to find ourselves in the rank of dogs, and the last one, being completely involved in attaining the divine rank of a Buddha. Okay? So this is the tenth of the 10 innermost jewels of the Kadampa. So, okay, so, you know, being completely committed to our Dharma practice, to progressing towards Buddhahood, and having that as the innermost thing in our life. And if it means some discomfort in this life, so be it. No. And I think, you know, that attitude of being willing to go through hardship is so important, because as long as we're in cyclic existence, there's going to be hardships. There's going to be things that happen that are uncomfortable, either physically uncomfortable, or people are going to criticize and blame us. There's always going to be something going on that doesn't meet with our approval. Okay? But if we're practicing the Dharma and we know we're in a good situation to practice, then we have to be willing to go through those difficulties in order to continue our practice. Because if every time we have a difficulty, we throw up our hands and say, I'm going to back to what's secure and familiar and comfy, then, you know, how are we ever going to work with the eight worldly concerns? Because we're just constantly giving in to them all the time. So, you know, and anyway, even if we go back to what we were, thinking that, you know, oh, I'll be so much happier, you know, I'm living here in a monastery, and, you know, there's this going on, and I have to do this, I have to get up so early, and, you know, I can't do this, and you know, maybe I'll go back, you know, and just be to my life as I used to know it. It was so much more comfortable that time. I had my refrigerator and my car and my credit card, and I could get anything I wanted, and that's happiness. I'll go back to doing that. Okay? But then, you know, so the mind can be like that. Oh, yeah, I'm going to go back and do that. But then think about it. What was it like when you were living that way? When you had your refrigerator and your car and your credit card, were you happy then? No. You know? So if we're going to give up the Dharma for a little bit of hardship and run back to a life that we think is comfortable, then I'd ask ourselves if that life was really comfortable or not, and if we were really happy, and if we ever really had security in that life. No? And check up and examine. Okay? So this kind of checking is really, really important in our practice, because if we don't do it, we're not going to be able to practice continuously. We're going to be constantly depressed and bummed out, and our mind is constantly going to be daydreaming about, oh, if I were only here, I could practice better. If I were only doing that, I could practice better. And, you know, we're just going to not get anywhere, really. Okay? So with this, what we're getting at here in talking about the eight worldly concerns and then the 10 innermost jewels of the Kadampa, what we're getting at is the importance of practicing the Dharma, and the first step of that being giving up attachment to the happiness of this life, because we want a greater happiness that comes from Dharma practice. Okay. So giving up the attachment to the happiness of this life doesn't mean that we put ourselves in suffering situation. Okay, we're giving up the attachment to the happiness. If happiness comes our way, fine, we enjoy it for what it is. We don't have to feel guilty because we're happy. We don't have to feel guilty if we have sense pleasure or if people praise us or something like that. Okay, what we're giving up is not the objects, but the attachment. Okay? So that's really, really important to understand. Okay? Doesn't mean that we, you know, we go out and buy the worst quality food and we sleep on a, you know, a cold floor. You know, we sleep on what's there. We can be comfortable, no problem. We can eat good food, no problem. We need to keep our body healthy. But what we're trying to work on is the attachment to these things, because it's the attachment to getting them and the aversion to not getting them that causes the obstacles in our Dharma practice and that causes problems in this life also. Okay? So that's one point, that is, you know, a point about talking about the eight worldly concerns and the 10 innermost jewels of the Kadampa. Another point of all of this is for us to really understand, what does practice the Dharma mean? Okay? So what does practice the Dharma mean? Does practice the Dharma mean wearing robes? Does practice the Dharma mean, you know, having prayer beads? Does practice the Dharma mean shaving your head? Does practice the Dharma mean waking up in the morning and meditating? does practice the Dharma mean having an altar in your room? You know, what does practice the Dharma mean? Okay, we have to be real, real clear what practice the Dharma means. So there's a real cute story, actually a very meaningful story about this. I forget who it was, if it was Atisha or Drong Dompa, but what, it was about one great lama, I can't remember which one. But anyway, this lama, this spiritual teacher, came to a stupa one day, you know, a pagoda, a monument where the people circumambulate. And he saw somebody circumambulating. You know, this man was circumambulating the stupa. So the lama went up to him and said, "Could somebody get, can I have some water? Thank you." Okay. Thank you. So the lama went up to him and said, "Oh, it's very good you're circumambulating, but it would be better if you practiced the Dharma." The man said, But in his mind he was going, "But circumambulating is practicing the Dharma. I mean, this is a holy object. I'm walking around. Isn't that what you're supposed to do?" But he thought, "Okay, well, I'll try bowing." So he started bowing. And he was bowing to the stupa, bowing and bowing and bowing. And the lama came the next day and looked and said, "Oh, it's very good you're prostrating, but it would be even better if you were practicing the Dharma." Man goes, "I thought bowing, was purification. I thought I was practicing the Dharma. So then he said, "Okay, I won't bow." So he took out some of the Buddhist texts and he started reading the Buddhist texts and chanting the text. And the lama came by the next day and said, "Oh, it's very good that you're chanting the text and reciting the text, but it would be even better if you practice the Dharma." Thank you. So the guy is like totally confused at this point. You know, I was circumambulating, I bowed, I was reading texts. I thought I was practicing the Dharma all this time. Thank you. I thought I was practicing the Dharma all this time. Well, I'm really confused. So he looks at the lama and he says, "Okay, well, what does practicing the Dharma mean?" And the lama said, "Giving up attachment to the happiness of this life and transforming your mind." Okay? So what he's getting at is even though the man was doing all these things that looked religious, circumambulating, bowing, reciting mantra, reciting texts, all these things that look like you're practicing the Dharma, the man wasn't transforming his mind. He wasn't changing his motivation. Yeah. He was still doing those activities with some sort of wish for the happiness of this life, or to look good in front of other people, or to, get some kind of benefit for this life, to get some kind of reputation, or for people to offer him things or whatever it was. Okay? So, if we ever wonder, what does practice the Dharma mean? Give up attachment to the happiness of this life, which means give up the worldly concerns, and transform our mind. And if we do that, even, we're in crummy clothes,
even people criticize us and blame us, our mind's going to be happy and our life's going to be meaningful. Okay? Because through the Dharma practice, we're actually transforming our minds and progressing on the path to enlightenment. Okay. Time for a little bit of a few questions, comments.
The last three, those mature attitudes towards being expelled.
Finding and attaining. So expelled from the ranks of normal people, yeah, finding ourselves in the rank of dogs, and attaining the rank of a Buddha.
Three mature attitudes.
Yeah, that was the three mature attitudes of being expelled, finding, and attaining. So it's very good to meditate on these, okay? The way you meditate is, you know, read over your notes and kind of ask yourself, well, how do I feel about that? You know? How do I feel? Is my life really committed to the Dharma? What's keeping me from being committed to the Dharma? You know? And then watch how that fear of being poor comes up. Okay, or how the fear of dying comes up, or how the fear of dying alone comes up, okay, or how the fear of being criticized by people comes up, okay, or how the fear of, you know, being thrown out of our social circles comes up. And then, you know, watch how, I mean, because that's all worldly dharmas, that's in there. You know, I mean, so you don't feel like you're a failure because that kind of fear and concern's in there. But let it come up and then think in the ways that I was just describing about, you know, what the real value of our life is. And that death is definite and the time of death is indefinite. And that what's of value to us at the time we die is not all of our worldly success, because that vanishes like this at the time of death. But the only thing that's valuable at the time of death is, you know, the good karma that we've created and the transformation that we've done in our own mind, because that's what's going to carry on to future lives. You know, we can have a fantastic, super comfortable life this time, you know, and then you die, and within a week, you're in total suffering. Yeah. I mean, even within one day you get reborn in a place of total suffering. So all the things that look like they're going to bring security and comfort in this life are totally fragile and unreliable, you know? Because it's very easy to die like that, you know? Like, yeah, we're dead. And this whole thing that we've built up around us to make ourselves secure and comfortable is gone. And what do we have? Only a ton of negative karma to take with us, because we've only been working for the happiness of this life. But instead, if we really see our inner potential, you know, and our Buddha nature, and we see that, you know, we have the potential to actualize, you know, like bodhicitta and wisdom, and to break the cycle of existence and to make our lives meaningful for ourselves and others, we have that potential. Well, you know, and we have the potential to experience the happiness of a Buddha, then, you know, why are we messing around trying to make this life, every little detail in this life, exactly according to how my ego wants it to be? You know, let's put my time and energy in a good direction and concentrate on what's important instead of wasting my time worrying about so much stuff that just disappears at the time I die. So it's something really to think deeply about, because it's this kind of stuff that puts our mind in the Dharma. Yeah? If we don't have this kind of attitude, we're not going to be able to really practice the Dharma. Yeah? Because because constantly the mind is going to have doubts, the mind's going to be pulled away by things that look more attractive and more interesting. No? Or we just start fooling ourselves, you know? And this happens for old practitioners too. You know, you're in the Dharma for a while, so then it's very easy, okay? I kind of carve out my own comfortable ego niche in the Dharma. I've made it this far, so okay, I'll just tolerate my bad habits, and that's okay. I don't need to work on them. You know? So we really need to take care, because otherwise, you know, we lose out on an incredible opportunity.
Would you say that this is mostly a matter of motivation or your intention, you know, the outward circumstances where you are, the ambition that you can be in the monastery or in the work situation, wherever you are?
Okay, so is it mostly a thing of motivation and the external conditions aren't that important?
No.
It is mostly a thing of motivation, but as beginning Dharma practitioners, the external conditions are important to us because we're very easily influenced by them. Okay? So, you know, whether we're practicing Dharma or not depends on primarily upon what our mind is doing. Yeah, so it doesn't depend on, you know, where our body is or what clothes we're wearing or what kind of hair do we have. Okay, so it is mainly a matter of motivation. But because at the beginning, and the beginning doesn't mean just for the first year, it's for a while, yeah, we're very easily swayed by our environment. Okay, so sometimes if we're very, very attached to things, we have to really separate ourselves from the object of our attachment because our mind gets so uncontrolled when we're around that. Okay, and so sometimes we find that we you know, do all sorts of, embellish all sorts of rationalizations for our bad habits and our attachment. Thinking that it's a Dharma motivation, you know, and saying, oh, it's not really the external thing, and, you know, I can give this thing up like a snap of a finger, so it's not really a problem for me. But we don't really give it up at the snap of our fingers. And we have this nice, you know, philosophy for why we're holding on to it. Well, why? Yeah. And if we look deeply, there's some kind of attachment there. So, I mean, we're full of attachment. So the thing is, we shouldn't, like, get down on ourselves and criticize ourselves. Oh, I'm so bad. I'm so full of attachment. How kind of Dharma practitioner am I ever going to be? I'm just a failure. You know, that's ridiculous, okay? We're going to have attachment for a while. But the thing is, to at least work with the attachment, at least try. Okay? You know, we can't overcome all of our attachment like this. We've had it from beginningless time. But work on it. You know, put some energy in and just start chipping away at it instead of just throwing up our hands and saying, you know, with discouragement, oh, I'll never do it. Or making up some elaborate excuse about why we don't have to. You know, let's just be honest. Yeah, I'm attached. Yeah?
It seems like since sitting and since meditation that, you know, some things are just kind of heightened. I'm even more aware of beauty and music and art, you know. It's even more intense than it was before.
Yeah.
To some extent, but in some ways it's almost, you know, seeing more beauty.
Yeah.
And we are supposed to be going for happiness.
Right. So
the art of happiness.
Right. There's always this is bad. So, again, it's not a thing that beauty is bad or art are bad. You know, that's not the issue.
Yeah. But still.
And you're right, because sometimes when we do meditate, then we see so many beautiful things as so much more beautiful than before. But the thing to do is we enjoy them and we let them go.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So that's the trick, okay? You know, here I'm seeing this beauty I offer to all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of sitting there and looking at it myself because my ego is feeding on this beauty, I enjoy it and I offer it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I see all this beauty in nature and I offer it to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and I make prayers that may all sentient beings have what they need in nature, and may the people in ugly, suffering places see beauty and have happy minds. So we enjoy things, but the way we enjoy them isn't just feeding our ego. We're trying to generate, in reaction to the enjoyment, virtuous attitudes, you know, of offering and sharing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I know one thing that I do, like, when I go to bed at night, I'm usually, like, so exhausted, okay? So I get into bed and it's just like, oh, this is so comfortable to lie down, okay? And then I think, you know, before I go to sleep, you know, may everybody in this world have a comfortable, safe place like I do to go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? And may people, and especially children who don't feel loved when they go to sleep, may they feel loved.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And may they be safe. And may people be free of, you know, going to sleep with bombs going off around them. Yeah? So I try, you know, there is attachment to the comfort of my bed, but I try at least, you know, to not just sit stuck in my own attachment and just, okay, I give this, I offer this, and you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then like Shanti Deva says, you know, may I become this for this, the people who need this, and that for that, for those people who need that. So somehow using it to generate some virtuous attitudes. Hmm? Yeah?
And how about if I'm feeling consistently too lazy or unmotivated to do that, or I'm just, you know, I'm more focused on my own not wanting to be bored, so I'd rather read something interesting in bed than do these things. Is there some way that I can kind of motivate myself a little bit more to do that?
Well, I think thinking about the advantages of practicing Dharma and the disadvantages of not practicing can be a good motivation. Yeah? And to remember that, like, it doesn't really take that much effort to change our mind. It's not like, you know, you have to go and, you know, the guys who pump weights, you know, I mean, you really have to sweat to do that. Okay? But to change our mind and the Dharma attitude, we don't have to, you know, you can even do that when you're lying down. Okay? So to just remind ourselves, hey, you know, it doesn't need to be that difficult. I can just think about this a little bit and, you know, make this kind of dedication. And then I think also remembering how good we feel when we do that, then that gives us further encouragement to do it some more. Hmm? Okay, let's sit quietly and meditate for a few minutes. So while we're meditating, think